Want to make a difference in your community but not sure how? Go to GoFundMe.com right now and start a GoFundMe. Seriously. Your next fundraiser doesn't have to start in a school parking lot or a church basement. You can start a GoFundMe today in just minutes. Fundraise for yourself, a friend, or family member, or an organization. All that matters is that you care about them. GoFundMe is the trusted place to fundraise for what you care about. With no pressure to hit your fundraising goal, but tons of tools to help you reach it, you can confidently start fundraising right now. Whether it's creative, local, or critical, your cause matters. And there's a reason why GoFundMe is backed by millions and chosen by fundraisers everywhere. It works, and it matters. GoFundMe helps you make a real difference. Start your GoFundMe today at GoFundMe.com. That's GoFundMe.com. GoFundMe.com. This is a commercial message brought to you by GoFundMe.
Welcome, Curious Minds, to the Security Nexus Deep Dive. We're your guides on a journey to unpack complex topics. And today, we're tackling something really dramatic, but also critical. What actually happens to intelligence services when political systems buckle under the pressure of, say, a coup or a revolution? You might think of these agencies, you know, the spies and analysts, as these immutable pillars of the state. But as we'll see, they're often right at the very heart of the upheaval. They face existential threats, intense loyalty tests, and sometimes radical realignment.
Indeed. It's a fascinating area, really, where the stakes couldn't be higher. We're talking about things that can impact national stability for, well, for decades. We're going to explore this through a pretty unique lens, drawing insights from global patterns first, and then diving deep into the tumultuous histories of a couple of key countries, Egypt and Turkey. We'll examine how these services adapt or sometimes fail to adapt, who gets purged, who manages to survive, and crucially, why does any of this matter for the long-term health and stability of a nation? Our mission really for you, our listener, is to help you gain a deeper, more nuanced understanding of these critical, often quite shadowy moments in history.
And we've gathered a really compelling stack of sources for this deep dive. We're looking at in-depth research by scholars like Laura Bacubsa, Suthan Krishnarajan, Jacob Niemrup, Casper Sackstrup, and Lasse Askeven. They've done amazing work on cabinet instability after failed coups. Also, analyses by John A. Gentry on the motives, the methods, and importantly, the consequences of intelligence purges. And the insightful work of Andrew Bouton on coup-proofing, particularly in the shadow of intervention. For our specific case studies, we'll be leaning heavily on Eric C. Gunn, historical account of the 1960 coup in Turkey, Bert Essayn and Sebnem Gamuskü's examination of how the 2016 coup in Turkey failed, Addison Mez and Onursal's critical analysis of ontological security in Turkey after that 2016 attempt, and Neil Ketchley and Gilad Wenig's really detailed study of purges following the 1952 Egyptian Revolution, alongside Holger Albrecht's comparison of coup-proofing in Egypt and Syria, and Junkoga Sudeth's work on military purges. It's quite a list.
It is, and these authors offer really rich empirical evidence and theoretical frameworks to help us understand these incredibly complex dynamics. You'll hear about specific actors, the strategic calculations made by leaders, often in moments of extreme peril, and the surprising ways institutions either persist and adapt or sometimes just crumble entirely under the pressure.
Okay, let's unpack this then. Let's try and uncover what happens to the eyes and ears of a nation when the very ground shifts beneath its feet. What's truly striking, I think, is that despite the unique circumstances of each upheaval, there seems to be this, well, almost surprisingly consistent playbook that autocrats follow when they're trying to secure their power.
Indeed. And that research you mentioned by Bacubsa, Krishnarajan, Niemrup, Sackstrup, and Askeven, it offers a really powerful statistical lens on this. They looked at this huge global data set, I think you said over 23,000 cabinet members across 115 autocracies between 1967 and 2016. And it shows us just how universal this pattern of immediate consolidation really is after a failed coup.
Right. So when a coup attempt fails, the sort of common wisdom is that dictators will immediately consolidate power. They'll purge elites they suspect of disloyalty. But how widespread is this, really? Is it a predictable pattern you see across different types of authoritarian regimes, or is it more of an occasional thing?
Well, this extensive research, drawing from that huge data set, it reveals a pretty stark and consistent reality. Failed coups significantly increase cabinet instability. It's not just a little bit. On average, an extra 8 to 11% of a cabinet is replaced in the year right after an unsuccessful coup attempt compared to other more normal years. And this isn't just, you know, random turnover or a typical reshuffling that happens anyway. It's a very deliberate, very strategic response by leaders to what they perceive as an existential threat. Dictators understand, maybe better than anyone, that their hold on power relies heavily on the loyalty of their inner circle. and a failed coup attempt. That's a very clear, very alarming signal that this loyalty might be compromised, perhaps deeply. The immediate aftermath is just characterized by this pervasive atmosphere of distrust. There's internal jockeying for power, often a surge in, well, internal spying, human intelligence operations aimed at uncovering any remaining disloyal elements. It creates this climate of fear that impacts the entire state apparatus, but especially the intelligence services. It's a moment where, you know, every glance, every quiet conversation can be interpreted as a sign of allegiance or betrayal.
That's a powerful and immediate reaction. So what's truly driving these purges beyond just simple revenge or maybe a raw display of power? What are the key motivations pushing a leader to make such drastic changes to their government, particularly within that very sensitive intelligence apparatus?
John A. Gentry identifies several motives, and they often overlap in really complex and frankly dangerous ways. At its core, leaders purge intelligence officers they believe are not sufficiently loyal. Loyal to them personally, or loyal to their government. And this perceived disloyalty, it can manifest in various forms. For instance, intelligence officers might show allegiance to opposing factions in an ongoing power struggle, maybe supporting a rival within the ruling party, or perhaps another powerful family or clique. Or there could be suspicions that they support a different political ideology altogether. You know, something different from the ruling party or the dictator's personal vision for the nation. That fundamental philosophical disagreement. That can easily be seen as treasonous. Another common fear, especially in these sensitive intelligence roles, is contacts with foreign nationals. Even routine diplomatic stuff. It can raise serious concerns about foreign recruitment or influence. Beyond external threats, there are internal factors too, like personal ambition that clashes with the ruler's interests. Maybe an intelligence chief seems to be building their own power base. That's a huge red flag. And perhaps most critically, a leader's fear that the intelligence services themselves have simply become too powerful, too autonomous, that they now pose an independent threat to their rule. And of course, the most extreme and undeniable form of disloyalty is direct participation in an assassination attempt or a coup attempt against the leader. That warrants immediate, often brutal, action. Each of these motivations really stems from a leader's fundamental need for survival and control, particularly when their authority has just been so violently challenged.
Yeah, I can absolutely see how that combination of factors would create an incredibly high-stakes environment for any leader. It would drive them to act decisively, wouldn't it, to secure their position? But it's not just about removing those who actively conspired against them, is it? You mentioned strategy. There seems to be a more nuanced strategic calculation involved in who gets targeted, looking at potential future threats as well as past actions.
Precisely. Dictators' purging decisions are highly strategic. They're aiming not just to punish, though that's part of it, but really to reduce the risk of future coups and consolidate their own executive power. This involves this delicate balance, often represented as a kind of loyalty-responsibility matrix. They're considering a minister's loyalty on one hand and their responsibility or influence within the government on the other. It's not simply reactive, it's forward-looking, a cold calculation of risk. They're evaluating not just who participated in the coup, but who could participate next time, or maybe who might not be a reliable ally when they desperately need them to suppress another challenge down the road.
So it's the strategic calculus. Who can harm you? Who is loyal? And crucially, who is indispensable? How do these factors actually interact in practice?
Well, according to Bokobsa and her team's findings, loyalty is indeed a primary determinant. It really matters. Ministers who have demonstrated stronger, consistent loyalty are significantly less likely to be purged. And this loyalty is often measured by pretty concrete factors, like longer experience in government service under that specific dictator's tenure. That indicates a history of consistent support, reliability. Another key indicator is partisan alignment with the ruler. So, for example, being from the dictator's own political party or inner circle, ministers from other parties or maybe those who are unaffiliated, they are significantly more likely to be purged. Their allegiance is just seen as less secure, potentially divided. Then there's the dimension of responsibility. Ministers holding more strategic or prestigious positions are actually more likely to be purged. Seems counterintuitive sometimes, but these roles represent a greater potential threat simply because of their access to critical resources and influence. This definitely includes those with guns, as they say, like defense and security ministers or individuals in charge of police and intelligence agencies. They command the coercive forces. Even foreign affairs ministers fall into this category. Not just because of diplomatic clout, but also their extensive foreign connections, which could potentially be leveraged against the regime. Furthermore, the highest-ranking cabinet members, maybe a prime minister or a president when they're not the ultimate leader, a vice president, or full-ranking ministers of high-prestige portfolios, they're also prime targets. Their public profiles, their substantial clout, it just makes them significant potential threats in a volatile post-coup environment. Removing these individuals is a key coup-proofing strategy. You eliminate potential rivals before they can act.
That makes perfect sense. You want to remove those who can harm you, but you also presumably need to keep those who are competent enough to help you actually run the state, especially if they are loyal. So the real insight here isn't just about eliminating threats, maybe. It's about a calculated gamble on human capital. Are you saying a leader might knowingly keep a potentially influential but loyal individual in a critical role, even if they're a known quantity from the old regime, maybe, because their competence is just that indispensable to the state's very survival?
Precisely. It's a stark illustration of pragmatism, often trumping pure ideology, especially in the short term. The research suggests that loyalty can, in fact, outweigh responsibility in certain scenarios. While powerful, disloyal individuals, they are unequivocally prime targets for removal, no question. But if a minister is unequivocally loyal, their high responsibility might be overlooked. Their proven fidelity could make them indispensable, especially if their competence is critical to the state's functioning, maybe managing the economy or maintaining key international relations. A dictator might face a tough choice: keep a loyal but perhaps less capable functionary, or retain a highly competent individual with questionable past loyalties. The critical insight is that in the immediate aftermath of an upheaval, the immediate need for functional governance, for preventing total collapse, can sometimes trump that long-term desire for absolute, ideologically pure loyalty. Of course, this often creates vulnerabilities down the road, right? These retained competents might still harbor allegiances to old networks or ideas, creating a kind of fragile equilibrium. Inversely, individuals who are less threatening but show even weak signs of disloyalty, they're still vulnerable as the dictator seeks to replace them with more trustworthy personnel. Maybe less experienced, but seen as more reliable in the long run.
Purging seems like a necessary move from the dictator's perspective, but also incredibly risky, especially when you're dealing with powerful figures who have their own networks. Can getting rid of perceived threats actually create new ones, perhaps even more destabilizing ones? It sounds like a dictator, in trying to prevent future instability, might inadvertently be sowing the seeds for the very instability they're trying to prevent. That's a classic double-edged sword, isn't it?
Exactly. It absolutely is. And this raises an important question, which Andrew Bouton's work on moral hazard in authoritarian regimes directly addresses. This paradox: purges, particularly when they target powerful officials with established networks and resources, can indeed paradoxically increase the short-term risk of violence. This might manifest as civil conflicts or even new coup attempts. The rationale is pretty straightforward. Marginalized elites, especially those with strong support bases either inside or outside the regime, can mobilize their allies from outside the immediate governing circle to launch retaliatory actions. Once they've been purged, once they've lost their positions, they often feel they have little left to lose. That makes them more desperate and thus potentially more dangerous in their efforts to reclaim power or just exact revenge. However, Bouton introduces this really intriguing variable that can influence a dictator's willingness to take these risks: external support. He argues that the anticipation of military support from allies can significantly lower a dictator's perceived costs of purging. This moral hazard can lead leaders...
Want to make a difference in your community but not sure how? Go to GoFundMe.com right now and start a GoFundMe. Seriously. Your next fundraiser doesn't have to start in a school parking lot or a church basement. You can start a GoFundMe today in just minutes. Fundraise for yourself, a friend, or family member, or an organization. All that matters is that you care about them. GoFundMe is the trusted place to fundraise for what you care about. With no pressure to hit your fundraising goal, but tons of tools to help you reach it, you can confidently start fundraising right now. Whether it's creative, local, or critical, your cause matters. And there's a reason why GoFundMe is backed by millions and chosen by fundraisers everywhere. It works, and it matters. GoFundMe helps you make a real difference. Start your GoFundMe today at GoFundMe.com. That's GoFundMe.com. GoFundMe.com. This is a commercial message brought to you by GoFundMe.
To consolidate power more aggressively, basically accepting a higher risk of retaliatory violence because they expect an ally to intervene on their behalf if things really go sideways. Bouton illustrates this with the case of Guinea-Bissau, where President João Bernardo Vieira's decision to purge his chief of staff, Sumani Mané, was apparently heavily influenced by his defense alliances with Senegal and Guinea. Vieira knew Monet is popular. He knew his removal would likely spark a rebellion, but that expected external intervention from his allies reduced his perceived risk. It made him more aggressive in his consolidation. This is particularly true, Putin argues, for strong commitments like formal defense alliances, where there's an explicit obligation for military intervention, weaker signals of support, you know, things like military assistance or arms shipments, they don't carry the same explicit promise of intervention. So they have a much lesser effect on the dictator's purging calculus.
That's a truly paradoxical outcome, isn't it? That external support, meant perhaps to stabilize, can actually increase internal instability by emboldening a leader to take more risks. What does that tell us about the nature of these authoritarian regimes and their risk calculations? It seems to shift the entire risk assessment from purely domestic considerations to a more complex international domestic nexus.
It tells us that for these leaders, survival often hinges on a very cold, very pragmatic assessment of power, both internal and external. If an international patron essentially offers a safety net, a dictator is just more likely to take bigger risks with their domestic power base, knowing they might be bailed out if things get rough. It really highlights the interconnectedness of global politics with internal regime stability, and the lengths to which autocrats will go to maintain their grip, even if it means tolerating or even causing short-term internal turmoil.
Okay, so we've laid out the theoretical framework, the sort of universal playbook for why leaders purge after failed coups. Now let's see how this actually plays out in the real world. Let's start with a nation whose modern history is just punctuated by military interventions and dramatic political shifts, Turkey. The 1962 was a truly pivotal moment, wasn't it? It marks a significant rupture in its democratic experiment. What was the backdrop for this event? And what was the broader geopolitical context, especially during the height of the Cold War?
Right. Eric C. Gunn details how, by the spring of 1960, Turkey was strategically vital, a key member of NATO, a crucial bulwark against Soviet expansion during the Cold War. The U.S. had invested heavily, huge amounts of financial and military aid, nearly $4 billion by the early 1960s, which is a massive sum then. They saw Turkey as an indispensable ally. However, internally, the country was in pretty deep economic and political disarray under the Menderes government, the Democrat Party government. Menderes was increasingly disregarding Western economic advice, which often involved, you know, austerity measures that were unpopular. And crucially, he was adopting increasingly oppressive measures against the political opposition, banning public meetings, restricting the press, even arresting journalists. This situation fueled rising anti-American sentiment within Turkey because many Turks held the U.S. partly responsible for Menderes's continued and increasingly authoritarian rule. Since the U.S. was propping up financially, so the U.S. was caught in a really difficult position, trying to support a vital strategic ally whose internal policies were becoming deeply problematic and frankly destabilizing.
So the U.S., despite its huge strategic interest in Turkey, was facing a real dilemma. Were they aware of the brewing unrest? I mean, the potential for a military takeover must have been palpable, right? It sounds like the warning signs were already flashing brightly.
Oh, absolutely. The U.S. intelligence community was closely monitoring the deteriorating situation. It wasn't a secret. As early as 1959, CIA Director Alan Dulles sent President Eisenhower a detailed report on the political landscape, highlighting these rising tensions. Later that year, Deputy Director Charles P. Cabell briefed the National Security Council, explicitly noting rising political tension and warning about the potential for military intervention if Menderes's repressive tendencies continued. They weren't blind to the possibility at all. The internal dynamics, including the Turkish military's growing unease with Menderes's authoritarian drift and his economic mismanagement, were clearly signaling a major shift was possible, even likely. The U.S. Embassy in Ankara was also getting regular reports, apparently, from both opposition figures and military contacts about the widespread discontent.
It certainly sounds like the U.S. was practically expecting a coup. So did they do anything to prevent it? Or perhaps maybe even encourage it, either through their actions or, crucially, their inactions?
Yeah, this raises that important question that Gunn explores in his work. While direct U.S. assistance to the coup plotters remains uncertain, there's no smoking gun, no definitive evidence has emerged. The historical evidence does suggest a degree of U.S. complacency, maybe even tacit encouragement towards the military's actions. The prevailing rationale among some U.S. policymakers could have been, look, let's allow a guardian coup to restore order, to install a more efficient and maybe more reliably pro-Western government before more radical, potentially anti-Western, elements could exploit the instability. Guardian coups, as Gunn describes them, they typically aim to restore order, then hand power back to civilians within a reasonable time frame, and importantly, avoid major foreign policy shifts. They're sometimes seen by outside powers as a way to sort of clean house without jeopardizing strategic alliances. Sometimes outside powers like the U.S. might even encourage such coups, maybe subtly, perhaps by withholding financial assistance at a critical moment or expressing public dissatisfaction with the incumbent regime, basically signaling that a change would be tolerated or maybe even welcomed. In the aftermath of the 1960 coup, remember, Menderes, his foreign minister, and another cabinet member were eventually tried and hanged for their alleged crimes against the state. It illustrates the brutal high human stakes of these political upheavals. The military then initiated a period of transitional rule, but it fundamentally altered the civilian-military balance of power in Turkey for decades to come.
That's where it gets truly interesting, doesn't it? The potential for external influence on these internal power struggles. Even if it's just inaction or a calculated withholding of support, that can be just as powerful as direct intervention sometimes. It really highlights the complex web of domestic and international interests that are always at play in these moments of regime change. Okay, let's fast forward several decades. To 2016, Turkey faced another but very different coup attempt. This time, the political landscape had shifted dramatically and the outcome was quite unlike 1960. What was the political climate like leading up to July 15, 2016, this time under the ruling Justice and Development Party, the AKP, and President Erdogan?
Right. Well, Addison Mez and Onursal, along with Berkazin and Sebnem Gamuscu, they explained that the ruling AKP had spent years in this protracted struggle against the entrenched Kemalist secular establishment. This establishment traditionally included powerful institutions like the military and the judiciary. They historically saw themselves as guardians of the secular republic, often intervening or threatening to intervene to prevent what they perceived as Islamist encroachment. The AKP, with its more religiously conservative and some say neo-Ottomanist vision, had been steadily consolidating power since first coming to office way back in 2002. They often utilized the robust state apparatus to silence opposition, for instance, by prosecuting high-profile military officers in those big trials like Ergenekon and Belyaz. However, the regime had also faced significant challenges to its authority. Remember the widespread Gezi Park protests in 2013, millions demonstrating against government policies, and then those serious graft probes later in 2013 that implicated several cabinet ministers and even Erdogan's inner circle. These events had created an environment of really heightened political tension and instability. There was a palpable sense of a fractured elite, even within the state itself.
So the AKP had already been engaged in these internal power struggles and faced considerable challenges to its authority, both from within the state and from civil society. How did the coup attempt itself unfold on that fateful night? And what made it so distinct from previous military interventions in Turkey?
The coup attempt on July 15, 2016, was indeed dislocatory and deeply traumatic. It triggered the society-wide anxiety across Turkey. It was a chaotic, violent night. Turkish Air Force jets flew menacingly low over Ankara, even bombing parts of the parliament building and the presidential palace complex. Tanks blocked strategic bridges over the Bosphorus in Istanbul. Key objectives like the general staff headquarters and national media facilities, like the state broadcaster TRT, were targeted in coordinated raids by factions within the military. However, and this is a crucial difference from 1960, President Erdogan quickly mobilized his ruling AKP base. He famously called on citizens via FaceTime, broadcast on CNN Turk, and also through mosque loudspeakers, urging them to resist the coup. Instead of silent military takeover like in the past, it became this very public confrontation. Thousands, maybe tens of thousands, poured into the streets in both Istanbul and Ankara, bravely confronting soldiers and tanks, sometimes unarmed. Tragically, there were heavy casualties among anti-coup soldiers, police officers, and especially civilians. This popular resistance, combined with the critical fact the bulk of the Turkish armed forces, including the top command, did not support the coup attempt, proved decisive. The coup failed by the early morning of July 16th, but it resulted in a significant death toll, over 250 people killed. It was by far the bloodiest coup attempt in Turkish history, and it deepened the collective trauma enormously.
And the coup failed, largely due to that popular resistance and the AKP's effective mobilization. What was the immediate and then the lasting impact on the state's intelligence and security apparatus? And how did the AKP leverage this moment of crisis?
The AKP's response was swift, and it was far-reaching. It was fundamentally aimed at reshaping what Addison Mez and Onursal describe as the ontological security regime. Now that term, ontological security regime, it refers to a state's fundamental sense of identity, its sense of order, and how it perceives its place in the world, its very existence. It's about feeling secure in who you are as a nation. In the wake of this deeply traumatic event and the pervasive sense of insecurity it generated, a very carefully constructed discourse was put forward by the government. this mantra of one nation, one state, one homeland, and one flag. This powerful unifying narrative served multiple purposes. It simplified the complexities of the coup, providing a clear, understandable enemy, the alleged Fethullah Gulen movement, which Erdogan immediately blamed for orchestrating the coup, and it offered a unified nationalistic response. It also channeled that collective desire for ontological security, for feeling safe and ordered again. It offered a strong sense of collective identity, order, and a clear future direction for the nation under strong leadership. Crucially, this discourse utilized really potent emotional frames. It tapped into historical anxieties, such as Severus phobia, that long-standing, deep-seated fear of foreign powers dismembering the Turkish state, harkening back to the humiliating Treaty of Sèvres after World War I.
So it was about far more than just physical security. It was about redefining the national identity, mobilizing support, and consolidating political power around that identity. What did this mean for the purges that followed? How extensive were they, really?
Well, Asen and Gumuşku highlight that the purges that followed were exceptionally extensive. They reached truly unprecedented levels in modern Turkish history. And they went far beyond just the immediate perpetrators, or those directly linked to the Gulen movement, which the government calls FETÖ. Initially, yes, tens of thousands of military personnel, police officers, judges, prosecutors, academics, were arrested or dismissed under suspicion of involvement. But the crackdown rapidly expanded. It came to include a long list of government critics. Many Kurdish politicians and activists, members of the Alevi religious minority, leftists, journalists, academics, civil society figures, many who had absolutely no connection to the coup attempt itself. The numbers are staggering. Over 150,000 civil servants were dismissed through emergency decrees. More than 50,000 people were arrested in the initial aftermath. This sweeping crackdown, supported by that nationalistic and unifying discourse, which effectively framed all opposition as internal enemies undermining national unity, actively prevented public contestation or alternative interpretations of the coup. It has only depoliticized the event in the public sphere. This allowed the AKP to consolidate a far more authoritarian regime, significantly shrinking the space for any oppositional politics and buttressing President Erdogan's challenged authority. It fundamentally transformed the state's security apparatus from one with perhaps residual Kemalist influences to one far more directly loyal to the AKP and Erdogan himself.
This is truly captivating in a sobering way. The use of an external threat or a perceived internal one blamed on external forces to justify such a broad crackdown and to fundamentally reshape not just the state security apparatus, but even the national identity narrative. It shows how a crisis can be such a powerful catalyst for a profound and often deeply authoritarian change, leveraging public fear and that basic human desire for stability and order. Okay, our next deep dive takes us to Egypt, another country that has experienced dramatic political upheavals, but with perhaps different dynamics and outcomes compared to Turkey. Let's start with the 1952 revolution led by those junior military officers. It fundamentally reshaped the Egyptian state, didn't it? Moving it away from its colonial roots and the monarchical system. What were their core goals? How did they envision transforming Egypt?
Right. Neil Ketchley and Gilad Wenig described the 1952 coup by the free officers, led by Gamal Abdel Nasser, as a revolutionary coup. They make a distinction. This wasn't just a coup aimed at modifying existing political structures or restoring some declining order. These junior officers, many from middle-class backgrounds, were infused with what Ketchley and Wenig call a third-worldist orientation. It was a blend of fierce anti-colonialism, pan-Arab nationalism, and socialist-leaning developmentalism. Their goals were incredibly ambitious. They aimed to repurpose the colonial-era state, which they saw as corrupt, inefficient, and subservient to foreign interests and the monarchy. They wanted to turn it into a vehicle for genuine national independence. They aimed for autarkic industrialization, building a self-sufficient national economy. They wanted republican politics to replace the monarchy entirely. And they planned comprehensive economic developmentalism to uplift the masses, particularly the rural poor. This meant fundamentally transforming both the state and society, which inevitably involved targeting the old aristocracy and the colonial era elites who had benefited from and were deeply intertwined with the previous monarchical system under King Farouk. They sought to create a new, modern, independent Egypt, free from foreign influence and internal corruption.
That's a massive undertaking, especially, as you said, for junior officers, captains, and lieutenants mostly, with pretty limited administrative experience. How did they approach the existing state apparatus, especially the intelligence services, which must have been deeply intertwined with the old regime and potentially hostile to such a revolutionary change? They couldn't just get rid of everyone without causing total collapse, could they? How did they manage that?
No, you're absolutely right. They couldn't just wipe the slate clean, however much they might have wanted to ideologically. The free officers faced this crucial dilemma. which Ketchley and Winnie call the threat competence calculation. It's a great phrase. They needed to purge individuals who posed a direct threat to the new revolutionary order, you know, die-hard loyalists of the old monarchy. But they also desperately needed to retain competence to actually achieve their ambitious transformational projects, like running ministries, managing the economy, conducting foreign policy. The free officers themselves, mostly captains and first lieutenants, as you said, they just lacked the experience and expertise in many key administrative areas, let alone things like complex intelligence operations or economic planning. So who was purged? Officials with direct and undeniable ties to the deposed monarch, King Farouk, were obviously prime targets. Very senior figures in the state bureaucracy were also highly vulnerable, particularly those who had held multiple government portfolios under the old regime, signifying deep integration and loyalty to it. Military officers who had not participated in the free officers' conspiracy were also high-risk targets, especially those in the high command who might harbor monarchist sympathies or command loyalty from troops. Specific ministries saw a significant turnover. The Ministry of War, for instance, its high command was prioritized for purging to ensure the free officers had firm control over the military. And the Ministry of Municipal and Rural Affairs, seen as crucial for their land reform plans and developing the countryside to undermine the old landowning elites, also experienced extensive changes. Even the parliament, which was heavily influenced by the king and the landowning classes, was heavily purged and eventually dissolved altogether. But simultaneously, who was retained? This is where the competence part comes in. Experienced bureaucrats and university-educated officials were more likely to be kept on, especially in technical or highly specialized roles. For instance, the free officers retained experts in the ministries of finance, supply, commerce and industry, and public works. They needed people who knew how to manage the struggling economy, which was absolutely vital for their developmental goals and maintaining stability. Similarly, they notably kept figures like Mamu Feltsi in foreign affairs. He had impeccable international credentials and expertise, despite his long service under the old regime, because the new Egypt needed experienced diplomats on the world stage immediately. And many old state elites, keenly aware of the power shift, proactively signaled their loyalty to the new regime. They basically tried to make themselves useful, hoping to retain their positions. And they often succeeded if their competence was deemed to outweigh their perceived threat level.
So the revolutionaries were, in a way, quite pragmatic despite the radical goals. They understood that while ideological purity and loyalty were paramount for the long-term vision, they simply couldn't run the country without some institutional memory and specialized knowledge in the immediate aftermath. They needed that expertise to actually implement their revolutionary vision and, frankly, just avoid state collapse, right?
Exactly. Nasser, the leader of the free officers, even explicitly stated later that he tried to embed free officers into civilian roles, specifically to learn the secrets of the profession of government. It was a direct acknowledgement of their initial competence deficit. However, many of these junior officers, thrust into senior administrative roles, were simply ill-equipped for the tasks. According to the sources, this sometimes led to significant issues of incompetence, administrative chaos, and even corruption as they struggled to adapt. You can imagine, right? A young captain, maybe mid-20s, suddenly responsible for managing a national budget or conducting complex foreign policy negotiations. The ambition was there, absolutely, but the practical expertise was often missing, creating immediate challenges. This really highlights the practical constraints faced by revolutionary regimes everywhere. While they desire radical change, they often must rely on a degree of elite-level continuity, keeping some people from the old system, just to maintain essential state functions and implement their programs. It happens despite the radical political transformation they've initiated. It's a delicate, often dangerous balancing act between ideological purity and functional necessity.
Okay, let's move to a more recent upheaval in Egypt, the 2011 uprising. This saw Hosni Mubarak, a long-serving autocrat who had himself risen through the military ranks, ousted from power after decades of military-backed rule. How did the Egyptian military's role in 2011 differ from previous coup scenarios, especially considering those coup-proofing strategies we discussed earlier? Why did Mubarak's strategy seemingly fail so spectacularly to secure his own position when the pressure mounted?
Holger Ulbricht's analysis offers really compelling insights into this period, especially when comparing Egypt to, say, Syria during the Arab Spring. In 2011, Egypt experienced not just the ousting of its incumbent leader, Hosni Mubarak, but also a partial breakdown of the regime's institutional infrastructure, most notably the dissolution of the ruling National Democratic Party, NDP. while the military, the Supreme Council of the Armed Forces, SKF, ultimately took over political power, its stance during the uprising was profoundly ambiguous for a while. Crucially, SKF preserved the core fabrics of the political regime established way back by the 1952 Free Officers' Coup, namely, the military's pervasive dominant role in the state and the economy. But this is the key difference. It explicitly dismissed Hosni Mubarak and dissolved the ruling NDP. This was a really complex maneuver. They maintained the fundamental structure of the military-dominated state, but removed its figurehead, Mubarak, partly to appease the massive public protests, but also, arguably, to protect the institution of the military itself from being swept away with him.
That's a critical distinction, isn't it? Preserving the system by sacrificing the leader. Why was the military willing to remove Mubarak, its own longtime leader, a former Air Force commander himself, while preserving the larger state structure he oversaw? Where did Mubarak's coup-proofing strategies, the things that should have secured his personal loyalty from the military, where did they ultimately fail him so badly?
Albrecht points to several critical failures in Mubarak's specific integrative coup-proofing strategies. These are strategies designed to bind officers closer to the incumbent personally, creating loyalty ties. But for Mubarak, they just didn't work as intended, or perhaps they even backfired. First, regarding officer appointment and personal bonds, Mubarak himself, an October generation veteran from the 1973 war against Israel, failed to forge strong personal bonds with the younger generation of upper military officers who came to dominate the ranks during his long rule. These officers were often 20 years his junior. They had no direct war experience fighting alongside him, and they were increasingly exposed to Western military training and doctrines through Egypt's close alliance with the United States. This created a significant generational and cultural gap. Frequent reshuffling of key positions, including the critical chief of staff role, actually prevented deep personal loyalty from forming within the military hierarchy towards Mubarak himself. Furthermore, those lucrative post-retirement positions, you know, governorships or appointments to state-owned enterprises, they came to be viewed by officers more as rewards for institutional military accomplishment, for service to the military, not necessarily as signs of personal loyalty to the president. And then there was the issue of his designated successor, his son Gamal Mubarak, a former investment banker with absolutely no military background whatsoever. He further neglected these vital relationships, completely alienating the professional officer corps, who saw him as an illegitimate civilian heir trying to usurp their traditional dominance and undermining their professional identity. Second, in terms of economic coup-proofing. While Egypt certainly had, and still has, a robust military business economy, these arrangements ironically fostered autonomy for the military rather than direct loyalty to Mubarak personally. Military establishments like the Ministry of Military Production and the National Service Projects Organization, NSPO, formed this huge institutionalized corporatist economic sector. This sector operated largely autonomously from civilian control, and even openly clashed with the civilian elites, especially Gamal Mubarak's circles, business-friendly reform agenda. For example, the military vigorously opposed the privatization of state assets that might threaten their own economic monopolies. And that huge amount of U.S. military assistance, averaging $1.3 billion per year for decades, further contributed to this economic autarky. It meant the military had independent resources and could survive quite comfortably without Mubarak's direct patronage. They didn't really rely on him personally for their financial well-being, which significantly diminished his leverage over them. And third, the social composition of the officer corps played a role. The Egyptian officer corps was, and is, relatively ethnically heterogeneous. And crucially, it recruited meritocratically, mostly from lower middle classes, prioritizing professional competence over kinship or sectarian ties, unlike, say, Syria. This made it less amenable to the influence of the upper-class Gamalists, Gamal Mubarak's civilian associates, who were widely perceived by the military brass as corrupt and out of touch. This professionalization, while enhancing combat efficiency perhaps, meant that personal loyalty to the incumbent president was not the primary driver of the officers' actions. Their loyalty was primarily to the institution of the military, and by extension, to the Egyptian state as they defined it, rather than to an individual leader, even one from their own ranks like Mubarak.
So when you put all those factors together, what does it really mean? It sounds like Mubarak's attempts to secure his regime through the military actually had the opposite effect. He inadvertently created a military that was powerful, yes, self-sufficient, professional even, but crucially not personally devoted to him.
Exactly. That's the core argument. It means that Mubarak's strategies, which were designed perhaps to keep the military segregated from direct political decision-making while benefiting economically and ensure its organizational autonomy within its own sphere, ultimately backfired completely when a severe crisis hit in 2011. The military, because of its deep-seated institutional independence, its robust economic base, and its lack of strong personal ties to the incumbent, chose to act as the ultimate savior of the regime, meaning the military-dominated state itself, by removing Mubarak. They acted to preserve the system, not the man. They prioritized the long-term survival of the military institution and the state it controlled over the fate of one individual leader. This contrasts sharply, as Albrecht notes, with regimes like Syria under the Assad, where personal, familial, and sectarian bonds were meticulously cultivated over decades to ensure direct, unswerving loyalty to the leader personally. That led to a very different, much bloodier outcome during similar uprisings. The Egyptian military in 2011 had the power, the institutional coherence, and ultimately the incentive to step in and save itself, and the state structure it dominated, even if it meant sacrificing its long-serving commander-in-chief.
Okay, we've really explored the intricate world of intelligence services caught in the crucible of political upheaval. We've seen the strategic purges in Turkey after failed coups, Egypt shifting loyalties, those inherent dilemmas of balancing competence with political reliability. But purges, as we touched on, they aren't always a clean, effective solution, are they? They can often have unforeseen, sometimes deeply damaging, consequences that can undermine the very goals they sought to achieve in the first place.
No, not at all. They're definitely a double-edged sword. John A. Gentry's work explicitly highlights these unintended consequences of purges, which can range from, you know, modest operational hiccups to quite devastating long-term damage, often creating new problems even as they try to solve old ones. One major consequence he points to is simply weakened operational performance. Purges, especially large-scale ones that sweep out experienced personnel, can leave intelligence services suddenly staffed with severely inexperienced, poorly trained people. And critically, they create significant knowledge gaps as institutional memory is just lost overnight. Gentry gives the example of Peru, where the abolition of the main intelligence service, the Servicio de Inteligencia Nacional, or SI, back in 2000, led to a temporary but quite noticeable decline in operational performance for the agencies created to replace it. Similarly, he mentions Myanmar, where after purging senior intelligence officials in 1983, the domestic service was apparently so weakened that North Korea was able to conduct a really embarrassing and lethal attack on visiting South Korean leaders in Rangoon in 1984. They bombed their motorcade. Gentry argues this was a major intelligence failure that directly resulted from the internal turmoil and the lack of expertise following the purge. The new, perhaps more loyal, but definitely less competent officers simply couldn't perform at the level required to prevent such a high-profile, devastating incident. Another unintended outcome can be the politicization and compromise of the new intelligence structures. It's ironic, isn't it? Sometimes the new personnel brought in after a purge aren't selected primarily for their competence or neutrality, but because they are strongly affiliated with specific political parties or factions that are now in power. This often leads to new forms of politicization, rather than achieving greater independence or effectiveness. The service just becomes a tool for a different political master. Albania, after the fall of communism in the early 1990s, is cited as a vivid example where the new intelligence staff are often inexperienced, poorly trained, and deeply connected to the emerging political parties. This led to a service that tended to serve partisan interests rather than broader national security concerns. And intelligence officers and agencies, and often their political allies, they don't just roll over when facing purges. They often fight hard to maintain their positions of authorities. This can manifest in damaging leaks to the press, sometimes even inaccurate or deliberately misleading leaks designed to discredit the purges or the leadership initiating them. Gentry notes this phenomenon occurred at the CIA during DCI Stansfield Turner's tenure back in 1977, where disgruntled officers leaked information to undermine his reforms and personnel cuts. Beyond leaks, there can be political actions, legal challenges launched through civil service protections, and various judicial maneuvers designed to assert their independence or undermine the legitimacy of the purges. This can create prolonged, messy internal battles. Finally, there's the persistent issue of continuity of culture. This is a really tricky one. In many cases, partial purges, where only some people are removed, fail to completely eliminate the perceived problems or the deeply ingrained culture of the old, defunct agencies. Veteran officers who might have been loyal to the old services or just used to the old ways of doing things can sometimes infect the new agencies with old attitudes, cultural norms, outdated operating practices, and even corruption. especially if there's no thorough vetting process, something like lustration. This means that the ghost of the old regime's intelligence apparatus can linger within the new one, perpetuating past issues despite changes in personnel or organizational structure. It makes true, deep reform incredibly difficult to achieve.
So, given all those pitfalls, if a leader genuinely wants to reform an intelligence service after an upheaval, aiming for real improvement rather than just causing more problems, what's the best practice then? It sounds like a really complex endeavor, and just removing people clearly isn't enough, maybe even counterproductive sometimes.
Well, Gentry offers several key recommendations for achieving effective reform through purging, but he emphasizes that it requires immense and, crucially, sustained political will. And that's often the hardest part, right? It's easier said than done, especially in volatile situations. Firstly, as I said, effective purges require substantial political will. This is often difficult to sustain over the long term, especially in transitioning democracies where you face legal and political challenges from human rights groups, opposition parties, the courts. Leaders often face intense pressure to just move on quickly, declare victory, but real reform takes time and consistent commitment. Secondly, he argues that purges designed to combat hostile ideologies or competing political orientations are most effective when they eliminate entire agencies altogether, and crucially, when they actively prohibit employees of the disbanded agencies from joining the replacement services. Partial purges, as we discussed, often just perpetuate the old problems under a new name. Germany's approach to the East German Stasi after reunification is often cited here. A dedicated commission meticulously vetted former members and largely barred them from public service. And Finland's dissolution of its state police, the Red Valpo, back in 1949 after it was seen as too pro-Soviet, are rare but strong examples of this kind of determination. They ensured very few former officers would be employed in sensitive government roles again, aiming for a truly fresh start. Thirdly, serious lustration efforts can be highly effective. That is, systematic vetting processes designed to examine former security officials for past criminal acts, human rights abuses, or deep political allegiances to the old regime. However, these demand really robust political will and strong, fair legal structures to implement them thoroughly. You need to avoid them becoming simply political witch hunts while still holding individuals accountable where necessary. Germany's denazification program post-World War II and their subsequent Stasi vetting process, along with Finland's actions, stand out as examples of such comprehensive, though often lengthy and controversial, efforts. Finally, Gentry notes quite importantly that in democracies, purges are almost always constrained by legal protections for civil servants. Things like due process rights, established labor laws, the right to appeal. This makes large-scale Soviet-style executions or mass imprisonments completely incompatible with democratic traditions and laws. It often limits the scope and severity of purges to things like dismissals, reassignments, or maybe pension revocations, rather than wholesale eradication or severe punishment. The balance between achieving justice or reform and upholding legal rights becomes a central challenge.
That does seem like a very high bar to clear, doesn't it? Especially in modern political systems where human rights and legal due process are rightly expected. How does the type of leader involved, whether they come from a military background themselves or maybe a civilian political party or even a rebel movement, how does that influence their propensity for and the nature of these purges? Are some types of leaders just inherently more likely to use violent purges than others?
That's a really interesting point, and June Koga Sadduth's research touches on this. Her findings suggest that the leader's background and, interestingly, their longevity and power significantly correlate with purging tendencies, particularly violent purges. Specifically, she finds that military leaders and rebel leaders who manage to survive in power for longer periods tend to exhibit much higher levels of violent purges compared to other types of leaders, like monarchs or leaders from established political parties. This suggests a potential selection effect, maybe. Leaders who possess the ruthlessness or the capacity required to survive for a long time in these often very volatile contexts might also possess, or quickly develop, the capacity for violent purges right from the outset of their tenure. These leaders often come to power through violence themselves, so they might be more accustomed to using it as a tool to maintain control. In other types of autocracies, leaders like monarchs or those who emerge from dominant party regimes might have different propensities for purges. They might prefer more institutionalized, less overtly violent methods of control and replacement reshuffles, forced retirements, co-optation, though this can vary widely depending on the specific regime's characteristics and the level of threat they perceive. It really underscores that leadership style, background, and the path to power are crucial variables in understanding how intelligence services are impacted by political upheaval and consolidation.
We've certainly explored the intricate, often brutal world of intelligence services caught in the crucible of political upheaval today. From those strategic purges we saw in Turkey after failed coups, to Egypt's shifting military loyalties and those inherent dilemmas of integrating competence with political reliability, it's clear that these are not simple matters at all. They involve deeply complex, highly consequential decisions that really shape the very fabric of a nation and can determine its long-term trajectory.
Absolutely. And what's truly fascinating, I think, is how often leaders, whether they're operating in firmly autocratic systems or perhaps in emerging democratic context, grapple with strikingly similar fundamental questions. How do you secure loyalty in a fractured state, especially after a trauma like a coup? How do you manage the expertise deficit that almost inevitably follows significant purges? And maybe most critically, how do you prevent the very actions you take to consolidate your power from creating new, perhaps equally dangerous instabilities down the line? The specific historical, economic, and social contexts, as we've seen vividly in Turkey and Egypt, they profoundly shape the outcomes, don't they? They lead to unique adaptations and, at times, tragically unintended consequences. It's a constant high-stakes game of political chess played in the shadows.
So what does all this mean for you, our listener? Well, it means recognizing that the stability of a state, especially in the aftermath of a crisis, often hinges quite significantly on these shadowy battles waged within its intelligence and security apparatus. Understanding these dynamics offers a really critical lens through which to view current events, maybe anticipate future trajectories of nations that are in flux. It provides a deeper understanding of political power, how it's maintained, and crucially, where its vulnerabilities lie.
And thinking about all this, it raises a final, perhaps fundamental question. When power shifts so dramatically, is it truly possible for intelligence services to completely reinvent themselves, to shed the baggage of the past entirely? Or are they perhaps destined to perpetually reflect the political will, the priorities, and maybe even the paranoia of those who happen to wield power at any given moment? Something for you to ponder.
Thank you for joining us on this deep dive. For more insights into the evolving landscape of cyber threats, hybrid warfare, and strategic security policy, do visit thesecuritynexus.net. The Security Nexus is a Maryland-based national security consultancy. We specialize in strategic advisory, education, and public engagement. Through podcasts like this, blogs, training, and consulting, we provide insight into the evolving landscape of security challenges. Our mission is to inform, educate, and empower both professionals and the public through clear, accessible, and actionable knowledge. You've been listening to the Security Nexus Deep Dive. We'll catch you next time.